Would it have been better not to know at all? I don't have a clue. All I do know is that the technology that is available now to provide information about the embryo's health can either be immensely reassuring or lead to some horrible decisions about what to do with that information when it's bad. Doctors performing IVF customarily put as many fertilized eggs as they can back into the mother in 48 hours. Some clinics refuse to put more than 3 embryos back, but no laws prevent the depositing of 4 or more embryos in most states in the United States. It's not usually that the doctors are stupid or cruel or driven by the desire to keep their pregnancy percentages up for profit motives. Rather, it's their experience that often no embryos become implanted and grow into fetuses. Or they know that the mother's eggs are getting less viable with each IVF cycle, or that she's about to stop the treatment because she can't afford it anymore. Whatever the motivation, some of my girlfriends not only got the blessed news that they were going to be mothers after that last IVF round, but that they were going to have twins or even triplets or quadruplets. At least 4 times a year, our local television news stations announced that some woman just had 5 babies. And though they're all incredibly small and several weeks or months premature, the parents are thrilled and staring into the cameras like deer in headlights. I don't know why, but the mothers always seem to be wearing glasses, which brings up the serious consequence of premature and underweight births. The oxygen that such young babies need has to be artificially provided, and a side effect is sometimes blindness or diminished vision. Take a look at the follow-up visits with those large families and count the children wearing thick glasses, and you'll see how frequently this occurs. I recently watched one of those makeover shows in which a mother of Quince had lost all her pregnancy weight, but her husband still didn't find her sexually attractive because she had a flap of empty skin about the size of carry-on luggage hanging over her low-rise jeans. The show paid for it to be surgically removed, but I'll bet those Quints have a dozen more tricks up their sleeves for putting the wet blanket on those fires of passion. Then again, so do singleton babies, so that must be an occupational hazard of becoming a parent. The novelty and possibilities of having the dream for a family come true in spades may at first seem like the answer to all a parent's prayers. One gestation, 1 10-month period of inconvenience and discomfort, and the couple can go from being completely childless to having the American dream of 2.2 kids, statistically speaking. It's exciting and exhilarating, and it gets scads of attention from family, friends, and complete strangers. And that feels wonderful after all the disappointments the couple has endured. The first ones to prick this balloon are the doctors. They know the toll it takes on the babies, the mother, and the lingering effects for both. Most doctors are not as enthusiastic about twins and are positively unenthusiastic about triplets or more. When the dangers and risks are considered, the doctor will usually present the parents with the option of terminating one or more of the fetuses so that the strongest one or two can more safely continue to develop in the womb. Talk about too much information. This is Solomon's choice, and no woman or man, but I don't think they feel it quite as intimately as the mother, outside of the Bible, should be asked to make it. You know what I just heard? I just heard that nearly 50% of all kids accepted in private schools in the major metropolitan area of Los Angeles, New York, Dallas, San Francisco, and Boston in the year 2007 will be the product of assisted reproductive techniques, ART. I can't give you any definitive statistics, but this factoid came up at a Resolve meeting I attended last year. Resolve is the national support and educational organization for parents who struggle with infertility. If you think I flipped my wiggy, just check it out yourself. How many fraternal twins can you count in your niece's playgroup? At your high school reunion? How many old friends are putting out baby pictures with 2 kids in a side-by-side stroller? Here's what it looks like at my kids' elementary school. 3 sets of fraternal twins, usually a boy and a girl, in each class of 45-year-olds. I don't care how many times stars like Julia Roberts and Gina Davis tell us disingenuously that twins run in the family. I think it's a safe bet when the mother is approaching or passing 40 and hasn't been reproductively successful in the past 5 or 6 years that she has turned to ART or ART to help her start her family. In vitro fertilization is responsible for most of these multiples and also for some precious singletons. Before I come off as judgmental or a hater, let me tell you that I'm not one of them. Yep, in a black-lit room, the universal sign for ovulation-stimulating hormone comes up on my forehead. At the age of 30, shortly after marrying my sweet, unsuspecting husband, I committed the following year to quasi-stalking him to have productive sex, meaning getting busy when there was actually an egg to fertilize. I deceived him about my intentions, preferring to look horny rather than desperate, and he bought it hook, line, and sinker. Men can be so teeny-brained, especially where lots of unencumbered sex is concerned. Bless their little hearts. After a year of getting jiggy with it, we still had no pregnancy to show for it. So I swallowed my pride and left my regular girl's obstetrician and skulked to a practice devoted solely to infertile women. It still hurts to admit that I was asking to be a member of a club that was populated with a bunch of people I didn't want to relate to. I think I wore a baseball hat and sunglasses for the first year. Hey, no ego problem here, folks. It was 3 more years of treatment in this infertility practice before I finally got pregnant. Keep in mind that this was in the dark ages of infertility treatment, but I got pregnant with our first child, a masculine child, as they say in The Godfather. Anyway, after getting shots every day for about a week and ultrasounds to check my follicles for about 4 to 5 days, I was finally given an injection of the hormone HCG, which stands for human chorionic gonadotropin, to release the egg or eggs that were mature. One Saturday morning, right before I was to hold a press conference for sports reporters, society die-ins, educators, parents, and athletes who were participating in the California State Special Olympics games, I drove so fast with a sperm sample from my husband held firmly between my thighs that I was stopped on the empty streets of LA by a traffic cop. Call me hormonal and stressed, or call me postal. I came within inches of taking the lid off the precious liquid that was nice and toasty between my loving thighs and tossing it right in the face of the cop. But as much as I wanted to mess with his little mind, I wanted still more to protect that little cup of sperm and deliver it to Nurse Connie. Although you would have thought my restraint with the police officer would have given me a free karma pass for the rest of the day, I drove right over a stupid pigeon that wasn't used to the fast pace of eating dead stuff from the middle of the street and flying away before a fancy German sedan caught up to him. The moment I saw his lifeless body in the street from my rearview mirror, I realized that I was the last person God would trust with a child. In pitiful tears, I pulled into the parking lot and dragged myself upstairs to Dr. Danzer's office to reluctantly hand my husband's specimen to Nurse Connie. I wept in disgrace as I said, "They're all dead," and I slid down the lab wall in abject hopelessness. "Come look at this," Connie commanded from her position at the microscope. I had no backbone of my own, but Connie scared me, so I always did as she said. And I walked up to the microscope to see for myself the decimation of the potential lovine population. To my shock, I saw little sperm bumping as if it were salsa night at Carlos and Pepe's. That visual image made me a believer again. And when the cleaned and spun and placed into a good swimming medium sperm were injected into my uterus in a procedure called IUI, intrauterine insemination, a miracle occurred. Our baby boy was conceived. Sure, my intimate moment was shared with Nurse Connie rather than my partner. But hey, he was peacefully resting, maybe even puffing on a cigarette and washing off all the baby oil with a warm, wet washcloth. I was sharing the afterglow with Connie and asking how long before I could get up and put my panties on, because I had the LA Times waiting for me. That whole reproductive nightmare left me with 2 psychotic tendencies. To be extremely suspicious, read, obsessed with rituals and magical thinking, and the secret belief that if something bad happened, it would be my husband's fault because, A, he didn't do the rituals I prescribed with proper conviction, if at all, B, he didn't concentrate on the pregnancy every minute of the day. C. He didn't treat me like the precious vessel that I was. In fact, he seemed nervous and afraid in my presence. Just between us girlfriends, after nearly 20 years, I still don't think I can forgive him. But don't tell him I told you. Zipper deliveries. Cesarean section deliveries are becoming almost as frequent as vaginal deliveries in many parts of this country. Even when girlfriends from this country go to, say Africa, to have their baby. The reasons are said to range from the convenience of the delivering doctor to the lowered risk of malpractice claims against your HMO, to the fear of damaging the girly parts, to the ability to get a tummy tuck at the same time, to the need for a girlfriend to feel in control of something after this dizzying 9-10 months with the body snatcher living inside her. I think that it's important to add multiple births to that Mad Hatter's list of reasons. There aren't that many doctors these days who will blithely sit while a mommy of twins, or more, tries to keep up her hee-hee breathing long enough to wait for each baby to line up in an orderly fashion and exit the mothership. First, time is money. Second, chances are these babies are premature and more fragile than full-time singletons and can't take a moment of oxygen deprivation or stress. Heck, under those circumstances, even I would go in after those little dollies. My first baby, the one we call Piu Yi, after the last emperor of China, the most holy and precious baby ever born to this world, the one I conceived with Nurse Connie, was delivered by a scheduled C-section. Of course he was. Part of what I believe was his whole, hello, I must be going attitude from conception to birth included nearly falling out of my uterus before implantation finally broke his free fall just above my cervix. It was my fervent insistence that fertility drugs and progesterone and all the rest keep him up in there that created my condition of placenta previa. And then, of course, when it was time for him to come out and own up to all the trouble he'd caused, we had to go in after him. Even though he was delivered 4 weeks early, by that point, it was him or me. I chose him, but my doctor chose both of us, bless his heart. Delivery grief. After that wild ride of getting a child, I was numb about vaginal versus cesarean deliveries. I never even tried to do the Lamaze breathing, because all that huffing and puffing was never going to be an option for me. Later, I felt as if I'd been gypped. I was nature's victim, and my entire experience, I thought, was felt secondhand via specialists and technicians. I was a host body, not a mommy. The people in scrubs put the baby in, cooked the baby, and pulled the baby out. I felt so robbed of something my soul yearned for that I sought out a new OB when I got pregnant again. The old-fashioned way, go figure. I searched for a doctor who encouraged FBAC, vaginal birth after cesarean, deliveries, and found the handsome Dr. Crane, who delivered my next three babies that way. Truth be told, by the time I was pregnant with our last baby, I asked him if he would consider delivering her C-section. He looked at me as if I were the sociopath that he long suspected, but I explained that I had tried it both ways and ultimately found them equally satisfying. I was mostly concerned with whether I would finally get so stretched out down there that my uterus would one day fall out and splat onto the sidewalk while I was waiting for a child to get off the school bus. When he solemnly looked into my eyes and said, "Vicky, the damage was done with the first vaginal, so it really won't make much of a difference," I shuffled out of his office and said, "I see him when my water broke." Just in the nick of time, one of my more candid girlfriends told me about a slightly more thorough kind of repair that the traditional extra stitch docs routinely do, which I could request or else schedule with a specialist. It was only for this nip tuck that I even got an epidural because I sneezed that little darling out. Getting back to grief, however, my girlfriends Maria and Mindy both prepared for childbirth with conviction. They didn't just want a vaginal birth. They wanted to do it drug-free. This was way back, before anyone listened to me or thought I might know a thing or two about this pregnancy business. Both of them labored for more than 20 hours. They were in the kind of pain that only fear and no end in sight can create. Their partners were alternatively sympathetic, running for an anesthesiologist and trying to keep the girls true to their naive promises to labor on, no matter what. I call these husbands golden retrievers because they continue to act sweet, loyal, and dumb, even when all evidence is making it abundantly clear that everyone in their little family had been unimaginative in how big and long and scary the pain of birth can be. The mom is half out of her mind and begging for drugs, and these guys are asking inane questions like, "Can you focus on your precious object just a little longer?" Those guys are lucky they don't end up with those precious objects jammed down their throats or through their hearts, at least. Finally, it was the insistence of their doctors that got the laboring moms and their clueless husbands to surrender and release their stressed babies via the zipper. Both Maria and Mindy felt like failures when the greatest moments of their lives occurred. Their babies were delivered by C-sections, and were scandalously healthy and robust, but the mommies were crushingly exhausted and disappointed. In one case, time eventually healed the trauma and grief, and in the other, subsequent successful vaginal births erased the memory. You want to talk about a recipe for postpartum depression? Women who have unplanned C-sections almost always have some feeling that someone took their birth experience away from them against their wishes. Sometimes they feel that the doctor or mate didn't have faith in them to endure their labor and find the strength to deliver vaginally. Sometimes they blame themselves for being weak and out of control. And almost always, they feel as if the decision was made and the next thing they knew, their surgery was underway. It wasn't about pain, but rather the fear, the high-stakes drama, and that they no longer felt in control of this birth. For a couple of years, my girlfriend Amy couldn't watch the video of her labor and sudden fetal distress leading to a speedy C-section. She wept and felt panicky and slightly victimized when she tried to view it with me. I don't know when the myth of the thin, athletic, sunny, ambitious, organic, and self-sacrificing woman became part of our culture, but it surely happened in my reproductive era. My mother and her friends looked at me like a freak when I shared my convictions about motherhood done right. But now I think they were a little bit right. Sure, I'm glad I never followed their advice to smoke to keep my weight down or eat as much tuna and sea bass as I wanted, but I could have been easier on myself, especially where my own sanity was concerned, when it came to pregnancy, delivery, and motherhood. Buying into the myth of the perfect mother is much an illness as bulimia, anorexia, or cutting, if you ask me. I don't know when we bought into the conspiracy that we could have it all the time. And I don't know how we joined the army of self-sacrificers, but we have, and it's a sin. Since we are the ones who accepted this nonsense, we are the only ones who can kick it to the curb. Girlfriends, this might not seem relevant to you for several more years, but it is my job as your older sister to share this one with you. You can do with it what you want. Having babies may be as natural as the sun rising in the east, but it's still a miracle every time it happens. If you feel anxious at times, it's just your humility acknowledging that having a dream come true is a blessing, not a right. And when yours does come true, you will appreciate it that much more. Chapter 13, Coming into the Homestretch. I can honestly say that I've never met a woman who, within a month of her due date, wasn't ready to end this maternity marathon. With the exception of my girlfriend Mindy, but she was undergoing house repairs as part of her nesting instinct and wasn't sure if there would be a floor to walk on by her due date. No matter how chipper and enthusiastic they might have been for the preceding 8-9 months, even the best of them get cranky and impatient. And who can blame them? They can hardly breathe anymore. They've grown too large for all but their biggest clothes. They aren't sleeping well. They have chronic heartburn and indigestion. And they are keenly aware that somehow, someway, that baby is going to have to come out of their bodies soon. They have also usually come to realize that it is easier to care for a baby that is inside you than one that is outside. There really isn't much to do at this point. Presumably, you would have had your baby shower. You will have also completed your childbirth preparedness classes. And aside from putting your shower gifts away, your baby's room is probably pretty much organized or purchased and awaiting delivery. If you've been working outside the home, chances are you have begun your maternity leave or will be doing so soon. You may find that you have the unfamiliar sensation of having time on your hands, time that you fill with alternating bouts of boredom, excitement, and fear. As if all this anticipation weren't enough to get you agitated, you will be increasingly irritated by the well-intentioned comments of nearly every person you brush by. They will say things like, "Wow, you're huge. When is the baby going to be born?" Or every week when you go to get a manicure or do your grocery shopping, the clerk will say, "You mean you still haven't had that baby?" Your mother and mother-in-law will call you every single day on the pretense it's just a chat, but really to see if you are in labor and have neglected to tell them. Talk about the watch pot never boiling. In this chapter, we will offer a laundry list of the physical and emotional adjustments required to survive the last month of pregnancy. These may seem like the longest yard, but if you want to be reminded that you are almost finished, look ahead to the next chapter. It's about going to the hospital. I can't breathe. If you are under 5'9" and have a normal-sized baby growing inside you, Just the act of filling your lungs will become difficult, if not impossible. The placenta, the space bubble that your baby is living in, grows upward and eventually pushes against your diaphragm and your lungs. At this point, most babies are head down in the blast-off position, so it is their bottoms and feet that are doing much of the encroaching. Call me crazy, but I found this breathing difficulty alarming. I tend to be a bit claustrophobic anyway, and this gentle suffocating sensation really bugged me. I would stand as tall as I could, fold my arms under my breasts, and pull up as if I could create more space in there for the baby and me. The best thing you can do at this stage of your pregnancy is to get on the floor on your hands and knees. This allows gravity to pull the baby forward and away from your spine and organs. It feels so good, you will wish you could crawl through the rest of your pregnancy. This is also a good position to try during labor for a change of pace. Another reason why you will find yourself huffing and puffing more than the little engine that could at the end of your pregnancy is from the sheer physical exertion of carrying around 30 or 40 extra pounds. An additional pregnancy condition that can cause breathing problems is pregnancy rhinitis, which is a chronic stuffy nose. Because the inside of your nose is lined with the same soft membrane that lines your vagina, it tends to succumb to the swelling that your vagina experiences. While full vaginal walls and labia can be sexually arousing, full sinus passages are merely heavy breathing without the fun. The miracle about this irritating condition is that it disappears almost the instant the baby is born. Until then, there isn't much you can do about it but sniffle. I can't eat anymore. Just as the growing baby has crowded your lungs and diaphragm, your stomach gets smashed flat like a pancake. You can no longer eat very much at one sitting because there isn't room in there for more than a few bites. You might think that this is welcome news, but don't get too excited because it doesn't translate into any measurable weight loss. This is probably because you eat less at each meal, but you eat a lot more meals. By this point, what else is there to do? Some of the girlfriends have reported that they have lost a couple of pounds right before labor, but not usually over the last entire month. Another physical condition that may lessen your enthusiasm for those hearty meals that characterize your middle trimester is indigestion. Those less fortunate of us may have experienced heartburn and rumbling tummies for much of our pregnancy, but at the end, this condition can become much more pronounced. By this time, your baby's behind is so vigorously pressing against your diaphragm that your esophagus is stressing out and not keeping your food down in your stomach where it belongs. You may be back to eating the comfort foods of early pregnancy, unless, of course, you're gambling that the old wives' tales are true and that spicy foods do indeed help bring on labor. No matter what you eat, antacids are the perfect dessert. I can't sleep. Being unable to go to sleep and stay asleep were my greatest challenges at the end of my pregnancies. Being tired was no guarantee that I was going to snooze when I went to bed every night. Some Stepford wives cheerfully told me that this was nature's way of preparing me for the sleepless nights that I would experience as a new mother. That's like saying dieting will prepare you for starvation. As far as I was concerned, a nature that was capable of giving chameleons the gift of the skies wouldn't be stupid enough to think that the cure for sleep was more no sleep. No, you can't sleep for two major reasons. First, the baby is pulling or sitting on every part of your body but your face and your feet, and those are swollen from water retention. Second, you are so preoccupied with what lies ahead, labor, delivery, motherhood, that you have a hard time turning your brain off at night, which is kind of ironic, because you will swear that you haven't been able to turn your brain on most days. Now is the time to reappraise your relationship with your bed pillows. They will grow to become your best friends, not only the one or two that you have always known and loved, but all the new pillows you will buy, or steal from your husband, to help them in their duties. The girlfriends and I agree that you will need at least three pillows by this point, one between your knees to keep your hips supported. I will explain why that works later. One propped slightly under your pregnant belly, and one under your head and shoulders. Even better, you should consider buying one of those full-length body pillows that are sold in a million catalogs these days. I bought one, and after I got over the shock of how very big it was, I gamely brought it into bed. It felt magnificent, but it created a barrier between my husband and me that would have required helium to ascend. My husband referred to my giant pillow as my boyfriend, and I actually named it Phil. Fortunately, or unfortunately, depending on my mood, my husband wasn't finding me particularly irresistible, so he never complained about the Great Wall of China between us. I think he might have been grateful. The one difficulty about my relationship with Phil was when I wanted to turn over. First, I would prepare to hurl myself from one side to the other. Then I would grab Phil with both arms and both legs and flip it over with me, like an alligator wrestler. It invariably shook the bed so violently that my husband nearly fell out, and the comforter would land somewhere half across the room. I'm afraid we don't have nearly as good or specific advice for making our brain comfortable enough to sleep. Your doctor may put me on America's Most Wanted for saying this, but I think that women who are coming to the end of a healthy and uneventful pregnancy deserve an occasional glass of wine before bed. A little toddy, along with a hot bath, not too hot, of course, can work wonders on the anxious insomniacs that most mothers-to-be become. Ask your doctor first, of course. Maybe I'm just a wino and waiting. One of the biggest culprits in the pregnancy insomnia crisis is the tendency to get leg cramps. I have no idea why we get them, but I do know that they are incredibly common. One minute you are clinging to your body pillow and dreaming about sex with some stranger, and the next you are doubled over in a frantic attempt to massage out a muscle that is contracted like a snapped rubber band. Stretching my lower legs and flexing my feet could make my calf muscle spasm so violently that I thought my Achilles tendon was being removed without anesthesia. My only advice is to walk it off. There is really nothing else to be done. I can't walk. Everybody knows that you can recognize a pregnant woman from behind, whether you can see her big belly or not. The first giveaway is usually her choice of shoes. They are large and roomy and definitely flat. In fact, they may even be scuffs or house slippers if the woman is beyond caring anymore. The poor dear's extremities may be retaining so much water that nothing else fits. Her feet, in these big, shapeless shoes, drag and shuffle between steps, creating a locomotive sound. These feet are generally not within shouting distance of each other, with one supporting one hip bone and the other about 3 feet away supporting the other. Topping this all off is the traditional sway back of the very pregnant woman, where she looks as though she is pushing her belly ahead of her in a wheelbarrow. Before I ever got pregnant, I looked contemptuously upon those slouching, scuffling women, wondering how low their self-esteem had to be to allow them to present themselves to the world in this condition. The least they could do, I thought with indignation, was to keep their legs together when they sat down. My mother, she of who weighed all of 120 pounds at her most pregnant, would tiss tiss behind these struggling souls and whisper to me that if I ever let myself go like that when I got pregnant, she wouldn't be seen in public with me. Well, I did let myself go to a certain extent, and by that time, I didn't care or notice who was seen in public with me. If my mother thought I was going to struggle to look good for her when I didn't even do it for my husband, she had another thing coming. At this point, the only person I could still pull myself together for was my obstetrician. I looked like Miss Maternity USA when I went in for my checkups. Legs and pits, freshly shaved, perfume, high-heeled shoes, clean hair, curled even, and a tasteful amount of makeup. I felt that if I couldn't pull it together for at least 1 hour a month, all self-respect was truly lost. After the appointment, I would hurry home to change into something huge and stretchy and pig out. One reason I was able to look decent in the doctor's office was because he never had to see me walk very far. If he had, he would have seen that I could no longer bring my knees together, and that my hip joints were so loose that I felt as though my thigh bones would pop out of the sockets with every step. Imagine that your bones are held together in their proper positions by elastic bands. In pregnancy, these bands relax to allow your bones to spread apart to accommodate the pregnancy and eventual birth. As I mentioned earlier, your rib cage actually widens to allow for the pregnancy to spread up into that region. And I'm sure you will be happy to hear that your pelvis spreads apart too, to allow for the little watermelon to make its way out. This is when a Phil pillow becomes essential. So I guess you could call this ligament loosening a good thing. But it's also a troubling thing. If you jump out of bed in the middle of the night to pee and fall immediately to the floor because your leg slipped out of the standing, walking position. I remember feeling as if I had stepped into a hole. So awkward was my balance, and so asymmetrically did my legs settle into their hip joints. If you've dreamed of doing splits again for the first time since your cheerleader days, this may be your chance, because you will be pretty flexible. The only problem is, once you get all the way down there, who is going to lift you back up? If left to your own devices, you would stay in the split until the baby crowned and knocked you off balance. So far, I have described reasons why walking is nearly impossible. Even if you are not pregnant, these biological changes would nearly cripple you. Let's add that you are now housing a full-term baby in your belly, and all the water and placental yuck that comes with the package. And if this is your first baby, it either has already or will soon drop lower into the pelvis in preparation for birth. This dropping, or lightening, as it is sometimes called, does wonders for your breathing, because it moves the baby away from your diaphragm, but it makes walking an even crueler joke. Do you remember those childhood contests where you held a balloon between your knees and raced across a field? Being 9, 10 months pregnant with a baby that is dropped can feel something like that. Except now, they're water balloons. Speaking of a baby dangling between your thighs, my girlfriend Colleen has coined the quaint term vagina farts for the squishy noises that sometimes emanate from between your legs when the baby is low and pressing hard on your cervix and the surrounding area. You can sometimes sound like a whoopee cushion when you walk. Returning to your weight gain for a second, the last factor to consider in your inability to stride or slink in your former way is the 30 to 40 pounds of fat, water, and baby that upholster your body. All overweight people waddle a bit, even without their ligaments being fully released and without a baby's head threatening to protrude between their legs. You don't run to catch the phone anymore. You couldn't jump for $1 million. And you lose your balance just getting out of the car. I cannot tell you how many of my girlfriends have reported falling flat on their face during the last few weeks of pregnancy. The good news is, the babies are never any worse for the trauma. My back hurts. If there is any way to treat yourself to a massage toward the end of your pregnancy, please do so. Ask around of other mothers, nurses, or child preparedness instructors, because they might know of a masseuse who's familiar with the aches and pains of a very pregnant woman. There are even massage tables with pop-out centers so that you can lie on your stomach and have your baby comfortably nested in a sort of pouch. I thought that this was the most wonderful thing because I really started to yearn to sleep on my stomach after about 6 months of being on my side. One last thing. There are certain delicacies about the very pregnant body that only another woman can understand. No matter how open-minded you might be about getting massages from men when you are not pregnant, when you are pregnant, insist upon a woman. By the way, all of the pregnancy books that I've read over the years suggested that the baby daddies learn massage and counter-pressure techniques to help their mates get through pregnancy and delivery. It always looked so intimate and sweet in the books, but I don't know of one single girlfriend who was ever cosseted through maternity in this way. One night when I was desperate, I begged my husband to massage my lower spine. He was so unimaginative in his massaging that he never moved his fingers from one single position, and I ended up with something resembling a rug burn on my back. My girlfriends unanimously reported that when their partners feebly tried to rub them during labor, they screamed at them, "Get your hands off me!" More about not wanting to be touched during labor in Chapter 15. It is easy to see why women get all sorts of aches and pains in their spines. The weight of your belly is concentrated within an area that is only about a foot long, and this can seriously pull your spine forward, thereby forcing you to hold your upper back unnaturally far back to compensate it for the forward drag. Also, if your breasts are particularly heavy, they can pull on your shoulders and upper back. The best relief we can suggest is to rest for a while on your left side with a fill pillow between your legs and under your head and shoulders. The left side is the medically recommended side because it allows for the most unimpeded flow of blood from your heart to your legs and baby. You can also try the hands and knees back stretches I described earlier. Or you can sit cross-legged on the floor, what we used to call Indian style in elementary school. This cross-legged sit lets your belly rest on your calves and off your spine. If all of this fails to bring you any relief, call your doctor and ask if you can take an over-the-counter pain reliever. I am getting so big that I might explode. By about the 8th, 9 month of pregnancy, most first-timers mistakenly believe that their bellies cannot possibly get much bigger. They are as round as if they swallowed a basketball. Their skin is stretched, and all the clothes in the maternity stores fit them perfectly. And then come the last 4 weeks. The pregnant belly of a woman who is about to give birth is not a graceful, rounded belly, but rather a thin covering of skin stretched over a child's elbows, knees, and bony bottom. I always say that you can tell a woman is finishing her pregnancy when her stomach develops corners. The baby is now so big and strong that at times its body parts are most definitely recognizable to your touch and seemingly recognizable to your eye. If your tummy isn't oddly shaped and threatening to rupture your belly button, your back probably isn't crooked enough yet. Think of yourself as a butterball turkey. When your belly button pops out, you're about done. My doctor says I can go into labor at any minute. As you come into the home stretch, you will begin to see your obstetrician more frequently. First every 2 weeks, then every week for the last 3 or 4 weeks. You may have noticed earlier that your doctor seldom, if ever, performed a vaginal exam once the pregnancy was established. Now he or she will start peeking up inside you again to look for some of the signs that birth is imminent. Your doctor will begin to give you reports like, you are 50% effaced and one center dilated. Effacement and dilation refer to the cervix getting ready to let the baby out. More about these phenomena in chapters 15 and 16. You will leave the office filled with anxiety, certain that you are going into labor that night, if you even make it through dinner. You will call your friends and relatives and put them on red alert in preparation for the call that you are in labor. When the baby still hasn't come 3 days later, you start looking forward to your next doctor's visit to hear more about effacement and dilation. I don't know why, but we all grasp onto this information as if it meant something. And it doesn't really mean much at all. The world is filled with women who live for weeks 70% effaced and three centers dilated. There are just as many women who go home after being told by their doctors that they are still closed tight as a drum, only to have their water break during dinner and their babies born before breakfast. I could spend the next 20 pages telling you not to set too much store by these measurements, and you would still ignore me. Just as earlier in the Girlfriend's Guide, I warned you not to count on your due date as an exact indication of when to expect your baby, and you ignored me. You will wish me wrong on this matter, because I did the same thing. I can't take one more day of this. There will come a time when you will have about 40 weeks under your belt, literally, that you start listening to folk wisdom about how to bring on labor and get this show on the road. I'm treading on thin ice here, but I would be foolish if I pretended that you haven't heard about any of these things and haven't considered trying them. You know what I'm talking about. Going on a long walk, having vigorous sex, eating hot, spicy food, drinking cod liver oil, and giving yourself an enema are all home remedies for curing a never-ending pregnancy. There was even a Hollywood restaurant that served a garden salad that was rumored to bring on labor. For a couple of weeks, it became a story on the local news programs. Doctors and scientists studied the piles of lettuce and other grassy ingredients, only to give varying reports as to which was the magic potion. Some thought it could be the cilantro, an herb used in a lot of Mexican and Chinese food. Others suggested that the exotic balsamic vinegar used to make the dressing was causing all the contractions. Either way, on any given day, you could go for lunch at this restaurant and find several ripely pregnant women eating salad with gusto. Of all the ways to encourage your labor to step it up a bit, walking is the most popular among doctors and fitness fanatics. I myself found an intravenous drip of Pitocin to be slightly more effective, but you already know about my desire to cut to the chase in these matters. I did commit to a walking regimen with 3 of my pregnancies because I was willing to try anything to get things moving along. I walked in deep sand on the beach. I race walked through shopping malls. I must have looked like a clipper ship at a full sail. And I insisted on taking stairs instead of elevators whenever possible. Sad to say, not once did any of my babies take the hint and consider moving out. Things were different after my water broke, however, and that walking business was suddenly a lot more effective. In fact, I had just enough time to stroll around the block a couple of times before I had contractions measurable enough to get the hospital to give me a labor room. I must seriously tell you that once your water is broken, your baby will probably be born within a matter of a few hours, or else risk of infection might develop as its pristine little bubble becomes exposed. Always call your doctor if you think that you have sprung a leak or that you are urinating uncontrollably. In fact, if your due date, myth though it may be, comes and goes without any unique event, your doctor may consider moving things along by breaking your water for you. By the time the due date for my fourth baby arrived, I think I would have tried to pop my own bag of waters if my arm had been long enough. But as they say on TV, do not attempt this stunt at home. It should only be performed by trained professionals. My girlfriend Caroline swears that vigorous sex at the end of pregnancy will bring on labor. From what I've read, some science actually supports this notion. Something about semen having a chemical like Pitocin. I also think that massaging the cervix with penetration of your mate's you-know-what helps wake it up after 9-10 months of sleeping and prepares it to stretch open. Then again, Caroline is well known for her insatiable lust, so maybe this was just her ploy to get her husband to consent to mercy sex when he would have preferred to watch the second half of Monday Night Football. A technique that used to be called stripping the membrane is now more euphemistically called performing a vigorous internal examination. It is, of course, done by your doctor, and only after he or she is fully satisfied that the baby is completely baked and ready to pop out of the oven. I guess this technique works for along the same lines as vigorous sex, but without the fun, in giving a wake-up call to your cervix. If you and your doctor agree to do this, be prepared for it to hurt like bad menstrual cramps and to be accompanied by as much blood as the beginning of your period. This vigorous exam may accomplish absolutely nothing. It never got my contractions to start. But I am told you stand a better chance of going into labor if the cramping sensation persists for a few hours, rather than just calming down and going away as mine did. My girlfriend Amy had great success with the 1-2 combination of a vigorous internal examination by her doctor and then an enema that she gave herself at home later that evening. By about 4 in the morning, she was pushing the baby out. Funny, isn't it? I don't mind the thought of someone putting a 12-inch stainless steel hook up inside me to break my water, but the thought of an enema makes me feel dizzy. Very pregnant women have varying levels of irrationality. I tend to get pretty darn impatient in my desire to move from pregnancy to motherhood, a condition I've always preferred. You may be more restrained, which is an admirable trait in a soon-to-be mom. You will probably want the baby out as fervently as I did. But your common sense and spiritual tranquility may allow you to accept the unpredictability of the situation. There is something so sweet and sentimental about being awakened in the middle of the night by unmistakable contractions, lovingly nudging your husband awake with the words, "Honey, it's time," and the two of you dashing out in the darkness to your waiting car for your exhilarating ride to the hospital. But charming as the scenario can be, I've always tried to talk my doctor into inducing my labor at a time that was mutually convenient for the baby, the doctor, and me. That guaranteed that the baby would be cooked. My doctor would be fed, rested, and in town. My hair would be clean, my legs would be shaved, and my toenails would be painted. It would also ensure that we made the dash to the hospital in the daytime, with plenty of daylight to help us find our way. Which way is better? My way, of course. Just kidding. Chapter 14, What to Take to the Hospital. A suitcase full of useful things. In addition to yourself, you will need to bring a suitcase to the hospital. You will have a bag packed and ready long before you go into labor. If, however, you need to go to the hospital and your bag isn't packed, just go. Do not worry, because there is nothing you will really need until after the baby is born. In the relative calm after the baby is born, you can ask someone to pack a bag for you and bring it to the hospital. If it is your mate who packs your bag, give him a written list specifically itemizing every single article you want. If you just give him general instructions like, "Bring me something to wear home from the hospital and some things for a shower," there is a good chance that you will be given a cocktail dress, tennis shoes, a shaver, and shaving cream. Make it easy on your mate and the hospital staff by bringing only one small, okay, medium bag. You will probably be moved at least once during your hospital stay, and someone is going to have to move your bag along with you. If you don't have several things with you, you will run less risk of losing something in the move. Don't worry that one reasonable sized, meaning smaller than a steamer trunk, bag won't hold everything you will need in the hospital, because you really only need something for you and the baby to wear home and a few toiletries. Okay, and an iPod, bottled water and snacks for everyone, but you, a couple of tabloids and a box of wet wipes, not to mention the other helpful items listed. Your going home outfit. Obviously, I can't know in advance if you're going to have a baby during a heat wave or a blizzard, so I can't pick your outfit for you, much as I would love to. I can, however, offer some general suggestions. 1. Wear something that is big. No matter how much you long to wear your old jeans and have your swelled figure back, you will still be fat, and you will probably still look pregnant for several days or weeks after the baby is born. Maternity clothes are the obvious, though loathsome, choice. Much as this may depress you in the anticipation, it won't really be a big deal when it happens, because at least someone will be wearing new clothes in small sizes. The baby. From now on, and for the foreseeable future, no one will be looking at you anyway, at least not when the baby is in the same room. 2. Wear flat shoes. You will be a little groggy and off balance after giving birth and lying in bed for 12 hours. The last thing you need is to try to safely carry your baby into your house while you are wobbling on a pair of stilettos. Also, you might still be retaining water, and you wouldn't want to be sausaged into anything too tight. 3. Wear a blouse or dress that breathes and is absorbent. Checking out of the hospital, putting the baby into a car seat, and heading home all conspire to make you perspire like crazy. And there is always a good chance that the baby will spit up on you at least once before you get home. Also, if you intend to nurse, make sure that the blouse or dress you choose opens far enough down the front for you to get your breast out without too much trouble. You will have your breasts in and out of your clothes so often in the next few weeks that you will be beyond modesty. You will nurse in the middle of a monster truck competition and answer the door for the FedEx man, bearing yet another gift for the baby, with your breasts looking him right in the eye. Most shocking of all, you will soon think nothing of whipping your breast out and nursing your baby in front of your own father. Yikes! You probably don't believe me now, but just wait until you have been hiding in your bedroom nursing for an hour while the family reunion has been taking place in the living room without you. You'll come running out like some escapee from National Geographic. 4. Look somewhat attractive. You don't need to kill yourself getting all dolled up. As I mentioned, you probably won't be the center of everyone's attention, but keep in mind that your picture will be taken several dozen times between your leaving the hospital bed and entering your home. Go for a little makeup and do your hair, and don't fret one more minute. But do brush your teeth, and for the baby's sake. Then hold the baby up in front of your face like a shield, and if all else fails, threaten to destroy the camera of anyone caught taking a close-up of you. Do not bring a nightgown unless you don't mind ruining it. The girlfriend's advice is to leave the pretty nightgowns and matching robes at home. Childbirth and its aftermath are bloody. And if you wear your lovely things from home, you will be soaking them in wool light for the next several weeks. Just wear the hospital gown they give you when you are admitted. Don't worry, you won't be wearing it long, because nowadays new mothers are sent home from the hospital so quickly that they barely have time to do anything more than brush their teeth and take a shower. Bring your own shampoos, soaps, and lotions. After you have given birth, there are no greater delights on earth than taking a shower and brushing your teeth. It will probably have been hours since you have done either, and the effect of feeling clean will be almost as good as losing 15 pounds. The toiletries that the hospital provides, assuming it provides anything, are industrial and in microscopic containers. Allah, the food is lousy, and the portions are small. Indulge yourself by packing some nice shampoo, shower foam, or soap, and lotion. Keep in mind, however, that your new baby has a virgin nose. The little thing could sneeze its head off if you have a whole room smelling like Giorgio. Select mild scents and skip the perfume and cologne altogether. Avoid putting anything on your breasts, be it lotion or powder. How would you feel if someone sprinkled White Shoulders dusting powder on your meal? Leave your jewelry at home. If your wedding band still fits without cutting off circulation in your ring finger, you can wear it to the hospital. Other than that, all jewelry should stay at home, where it won't get lost in the shuffle. You won't even need a watch, because your every ready birth coach will have one. And failing that, every maternity room I've ever seen has a huge wall clock, like the ones we had in school. Who knows? You may look so naked without your earrings and pendant that your mate may actually be inspired to go out and buy you a little bauble as a reward for your valor in the delivery room. Bring a pillow or two. We've already discussed the ever-deepening love you will have for your pillows during pregnancy. You sleep with them between your legs. You hug them against your chest. You even take them in the car for your ride to the hospital to deliver. As loving and supportive as they have been up to now, they have never been more worthy of your devotion than when you rest gently on them in your hospital bed. I don't know what hospital standard issue pillows are made of, but I am tempted to say sawdust or crumpled plaster. Your own pillows will not only help you sleep comfortably, which you most certainly deserve at this point, but they will also help bolster you and the baby at feeding time. Best of all, they smell like home. Just remember to leave your best white pillowcases at home, for obvious reasons. Bring bedroom slippers. I know that hospitals are supposed to be all sterile and such, but I have my doubts, especially where the carpets are concerned. When you are just resting in your room, you may find a thick pair of socks sufficient to keep your feet warm and cootie-free. But if you are prodded into strolling around the whole wing to get your intestines working again, you will want to have some slippers that are flat and comfy and not too ugly. It is definitely best to skip the little mules with the feathers because your balance might not be too good. Or worse, your legs might actually look good enough to arouse your partner and give him a hankering for sex. Yikes! For your partner, leave this page open on your partner's pillow or pasted over his toilet. Attention, daddies! The Girlfriend's Guide heartily recommends that you show up with a gift of some sort shortly after the baby is born. You will almost never go wrong with jewelry, since it will fit even before your wife has lost her baby fat. It indicates an appreciation of the value of the heroic job she has just performed. If people get generous rewards simply for finding lost dogs, your wife is now entitled to the Hope Diamond for the service she has just rendered. Bring lots of socks. My girlfriends and I recommend that you bring thick socks and lots of them. You will wear your first pair during labor, a time when lots of women get cold hands and feet, literally and figuratively. Your doctor will probably let you continue wearing your socks during delivery, but you will want to throw them away as soon as your consciousness returns, because they will probably be pretty bloody. The other pairs are for you to wear in bed, in the hospital, so that when you get up to use the toilet, your little tootsies won't get cold or contaminated. Chances are you will end up tossing a couple of these pairs, too, because you will inevitably sense too late that your diaper has runneth over as you streak to the bathroom. There will be blood and watery stuff running down your legs and into your socks. Don't spend too much time trying to visualize this. Just take my word for it and move on. Bring big girl panties. Unlike the socks, you will not need your underwear during labor and delivery, since most doctors agree that they tend to be a hindrance. You will, however, need at least 3 or 4 pairs for your hospital stay, no matter how brief. After the baby is born and all the other pregnancy stuff has come out of you, a nurse will put a couple of sanitary pads on you, and you will lie in bed on disposable square mats. For the first few hours, you might skip underwear, because this is usually when the nurse will bring you ice packs for your swollen pee-pee. Plus, she will want to look at how you're doing down there every few hours. After the ice pack period has passed, you will want your own underwear, both for modesty's sake and also to keep those sanitary pads where they belong. For this, we recommend full-cut briefs, even if you were a G-string devotee during your pregnancy. No G-string is going to offer a whit of support for the pads you will need down there to soak up all the liquids that pour out of you for days after birth. And besides, after a vaginal birth and a couple of stitches, you will look upon your favorite thong as a vicious instrument of torture. No, what you need are big, soft, granny panties that feel soft and cushy. Bring lip balm. Something about childbirth dries out the lips. Even for those of us who did our Lamaze breathing, only for the time it took to yell for the anesthesiologist. Certainly you are being dehydrated by losing so much water during birth, but in addition, you won't be given anything to drink during labor and delivery for fear that it will make you nauseous. If you don't think ahead to bring something for your lips, you will probably end up all chapped and cracked. You can't prevent that from happening to your nipples, but a good lip cream will help your mouth. Bring a pen. At first I was going to suggest that you bring paper too, but then I was reminded by my girlfriends that between learning to feed your baby, welcoming all your visitors, sleeping, and trying to relax enough to go to the bathroom, you will have no time for composition. If you are deeply committed to your journal, then go ahead and bring it if it makes you feel better. but keep all the thank you notes and birth announcement envelopes at home. My girlfriend Dorothea suggests, after giving birth to her second child, that all baby announcement envelopes, or at least labels, should be addressed and stamped during those last boring weeks of pregnancy. Then, when the baby is born, all you have to do is phone in the essential information to the stationers and later beg your mother or girlfriends to stuff the envelopes and drop them in a mailbox for you. Getting back to the pen, you will be asked to fill out several forms for such things as birth certificates, baby photos, and breakfast menus during your hospital stay. The nurse, after an hour of searching, would generally find a 3-inch pencil with no eraser for you to use. Not only will your hand cramp up, but the lead will wear down before you even get to your dinner request. While bringing a pen is by no means essential, you'll find it's the little things that often mean the most. Bring something to eat. My girlfriend Donna actually had the temerity to tell me that the hospital where she delivered had a hospitality buffet set up several hours a day for the maternity patients and their husbands. She suspects that strangers from other wards frequently came in and helped themselves. Do not expect to find the same setup at your own hospital. In fact, getting anyone to bring you juice or a snack when it is not a scheduled mealtime is the dictionary example for the word futile. After a task as arduous as delivering a baby, you will be starved. Contributing to this hunger is the fact that your body is getting ready to go into milk production. You will be tempted to accept your husband's sweet offer to dash down to the cafeteria and bring you back something to eat. Keep in mind, however, that you will not see the man again for nearly an hour, because he will tuck into a 4-course meal for himself while he is waiting for your tuna sandwich to be wrapped to go. Remember, labor and delivery have taken their toll on him too. You will be so grateful to yourself if you have planned ahead and stashed some bottled water, boxed juice, and non-perishable snacks, such as granola bars or dried fruit or crackers in your suitcase. Try to avoid the candy bars and cookies at this time. Much as you may love chocolate, your body is sapped and needs more nutritious replenishment. Besides, a lot of babies can't digest the milk of a mother who has been eating milk duds all night, so hold off on the junk. Bring something to read. Most hospital rooms have televisions, but if you have time on your hands, you might want to read. Personal experience has shown me that linear thinking is almost totally absent in new mothers. So don't bring anything that requires concentration or memory, because you will have neither. A magazine or two will be quite intellectually challenging, especially if they have complicated things such as the Cosmo tests about whether your sex life is as good as it should be, or Glamour's do's and don'ts. Bring your own sanitary pads. Things may vary from hospital to hospital, but when I had my kids, I was given the kind of sanitary pads that needed a belt or safety pins to keep them in place. Jeez, I hadn't seen those things since I read the book growing up and liking it. What a relic. What you need are the Maxius pads manufactured with the adhesive strips on the backs. Bring the jumbo box because you will really use them fast, often two at a time, for the first couple of days. Even if you have had a cesarean section. If you're lucky, the hospital will provide them and you'll never use yours, but better safe than sorry. Bring a nursing bra. If you know you want to breastfeed your baby, or if you are uncertain you might give it a try, you should bring a nursing bra to the hospital with you. You will appreciate the support and protection, even if you don't intend to nurse, and you should continue wearing your industrial strength maternity bras because you will still experience the filling of your breasts. Even though babies want to and should nurse right after they are born, they are not getting mother's milk yet. I am sure you've read all about colostrum, the yellowish fluid that the baby sucks from your breasts preceding the manufacturing of milk. You have a wonderful window of opportunity to learn to nurse during this colostrum stage because the baby isn't starving to death and your breasts aren't too big to maneuver. The day your milk